thought themselves superior to the occasional orphans in attendance. This feeling prevailed the most strongly among those students who came from families where they were neglected or abused, or both. And thus grades 1 through 6 for Homer Wells were comprised of experiences more combative than educational. He missed 3 Thursdays out of 4 for years, and at least one other day every week because of a late train. In the winters, he missed a day a week because he was sick. And when there was too much snow, the trains didn't run. The 3 tutors suffered the same perils pressed upon train service in those years, because they all came to St. Cloud's from 3 Mile Falls. There was a woman who taught math. She was a bookkeeper for a textile mill. A real-life accountant, Nurse Edna claimed. But she refused to have anything to do with algebra or geometry, and she firmly preferred addition and subtraction to multiplication and division. Homer Wells would be a grown man before Dr. Larch would discover that the boy had never learned the multiplication table. Another woman, a well-to-do plumber's widow, taught grammar and spelling. Her method was rigorous and messy. She presented great clumps of uncapitalized, misspelled, and unpunctuated words, and demanded that the clumps be put into proper sentences, meticulously punctuated and correctly spelled. She then corrected the corrections. The final document, she employed a system of different colored inks, resembled a much revised treaty between 2 semi-literate countries at war. The text itself was always strange to Homer Wells, even when it was finally correct. This was because the woman borrowed heavily from a family hymnal, and Homer Wells had never seen a church or heard a hymn, unless one counted Christmas carols or the songs Mrs. Grogan sang, and the plumber's widow was not such a fool that she used Christmas carols. Homer Wells used to have nightmares about deciphering the passages that the plumber's widow concocted. O Lord, me got, when I en ausum wundor, consider all the worlds thee hens half mad. Or there was this one. O ruck of edges, clift fur me, let my hid myself in thee, and so forth. The 3rd tutor, a retired schoolteacher from Camden, was an old, unhappy man who lived with his daughter's family because he couldn't take care of himself. He taught history, but he had no books. He taught the world from memory. He said the dates weren't important. He was capable of sustaining a rant about Mesopotamia for a full half hour, but when he paused for breath or for a sip of water, he would find himself in Rome or in Troy. He would recite long, uninterrupted passages from Thucydides, but a mere swallow would transport him to Elba with Napoleon. I think, Nurse Edna once remarked to Dr. Larch, that he manages to give a sense of the scope of history. Nurse Angela rolled her eyes. Whenever I try to listen to him, she said, I can think of 100 good reasons for war. She meant, Homer Wells understood, that no one should live so long. It is easy to understand why Homer was more fond of doing chores than he was fond of education. Homer's favorite chore was selecting, for Dr. Larch, the evening reading. He was supposed to estimate a passage that would take Dr. Larch exactly 20 minutes to read. This was difficult because when Homer read aloud to himself, he read more slowly than Dr. Larch, but when he simply read to himself, he read more quickly than Dr. Larch could read aloud. At 20 minutes an evening, it took Dr. Larch several months to read Great Expectations, and more than a year to read David Copperfield, at the end of which time St. Larch announced to Homer that he would start at the beginning of Great Expectations again. Except for Homer, the orphans who'd first heard Great Expectations had moved on. Almost none of them understood Great Expectations, or David Copperfield anyway. They were not only too young for the Dickensian language, they were also too young to comprehend the usual language of St. Cloud's. What mattered to Dr. Larch was the idea of reading aloud. It was a successful soporific for the children who didn't know what they were listening to, and for those few who understood the words in the story, the evening reading provided them with a way to leave St. Cloud's in their dreams, in their imaginations. Dickens was a personal favorite of Dr. Larch. It was no accident, of course, that both Great Expectations and David Copperfield were concerned with orphans. "What in hell else would you read to an orphan?" Dr. Larch inquired in his journal. And so Homer Wells was familiar with the vision of that gibbet in the marshland, with some chains hanging to it which had once held a pirate. And Homer's imagination of the orphan Pip and the convict Magwitch, the beautiful Estella, the vengeful Miss Havisham, provided him with sharper details when, falling asleep, he would follow the ghostly mothers who left St. Cloud's in the cover of darkness and boarded the horse-drawn coach car, or later, the bus which replaced the coach and gave Homer Wells his first sensation of the passage of time, of progress. Soon after the bus replaced the coach, all bus service in St. Cloud's was discontinued. Thereafter, the mothers walked. This gave Homer further understanding of progress. The mothers he saw in his sleep never changed. But the men who had not bothered to accompany them to St. Cloud's, where were they? Homer liked the part in Great Expectations when Pip is just starting out, and he says that the mists had all solemnly risen, and the world lay spread before me. A boy from St. Cloud's knew plenty about mists. They were what shrouded the river, the town, the orphanage itself. They drifted downriver from Three-Mile Falls. They were what concealed one's parents. They were the clouds of St. Cloud's that allowed one's parents to slip away, unseen. "Homer," Dr. Larch would say, "one day you'll get to see the ocean. You've only been as far as the mountains. They're not nearly as spectacular as the sea. There's fog on the coast. It can be worse than the fog here. And when the fog lifts, Homer..." "Well," said St. Larch, "that's a moment you must see." But Homer Wells had already seen it. He'd already imagined it. The mists, all solemnly risen. He smiled at Dr. Larch and excused himself. It was time to ring a bell. That was what he was doing, bell-ringing, when his fourth foster family arrived at St. Cloud's to fetch him. Dr. Larch had prepared him very well. Homer had no trouble recognizing the couple. They were, in today's language, sports-oriented. In Maine, in 1930-something, when Homer Wells was 12, the couple who wanted to adopt him were simply thought fanatical about everything that could be done outdoors. They were a whitewater canoeing couple, an ocean-sailing couple, a mountain-climbing, deep-sea-diving, wilderness-camping couple, a 100-mile, at forced march pace, tramping couple, athletes, but not of organized sports. They were not a sissy-sport couple. The day they arrived at St. Cloud's, Homer Wells rang the bell for 10 o'clock 14 times. He was transfixed by them, by their solid, muscular looks, by their loping strides, by his safari hat, by her bushwhacking machete in a long sheath, with Indian beads, at her cartridge belt. They both wore boots that looked lived in. Their vehicle was a homemade pioneer of what would years later be called a camper. It looked equipped to capture and contain a rhino. Homer instantly foresaw that he would be made to hunt bears, wrestle alligators, in short, live off the land. Nurse Edna stopped him before he could ring 15 o'clock. Wilbur Larch was being cautious. He didn't fear for Homer's mind. A boy who has read Great Expectations and David Copperfield by himself, twice each, and had each word of both books read aloud to him also twice, is more mentally prepared than most. Dr. Larch felt that the boy's physical or athletic development had been less certain. Sports seemed frivolous to Larch when compared to the learning of more necessary, more fundamental skills. Larch knew that the St. Cloud's sports program, which consisted of indoor football in the dining hall when there was bad weather, was inadequate. In good weather, the boys and girls divisions played tag or kick the can, or sometimes Nurse Edna or Nurse Angela pitched for stickball. The ball was composed of several socks wrapped in adhesive tape. It moved poorly. Larch had nothing against an outdoor life. He also knew nothing about one. He guessed that a little of its wasted energy, wasted to Larch, would be good for Homer. Possibly such physical activity might enhance the boy's sense of humor. The couple's name was a source of humor for Nurse Edna and Nurse Angela. Their married name was Winkle. He was called Grant, she was called Billy. They were members of Maine's very small money class. Their business, as they ridiculously called it, didn't make a cent, but they didn't need to make money. They were born rich. Their needless enterprise consisted of taking people to the wilderness and creating for them the sensation that they were lost there. They also took people shooting down rapids in frail rafts or canoes, creating for them the sensation that they would surely be bashed to death before they drowned. The Winkles were in the business of manufacturing sensations for people who were so removed from any sensations of their own making or circumstances that only high but simulated adventure could provoke any response from them at all. Dr. Larch was not impressed with the Winkles' business. He knew that they were simply rich people who did exactly what they wanted to do and needed to call what they did something more serious-sounding than play. What impressed Larch with the Winkles was that they were deliriously happy, among adults and among orphans. Wilbur Larch noted that delirious happiness was rare. "In other parts of the world," Dr. Larch wrote, "delirious happiness is thought to be a state of mind. Here in St. Cloud's, we recognize that delirious happiness is possible only for the totally mindless. I would call it, therefore, that thing most rare, a state of the soul." Larch was often facetious when he discussed the soul. He liked to tease Nurse Edna and Nurse Angela in the operating room, where the subject of the soul could catch the dear nurses off guard. Once, with a body open on the table, Larch pointed dramatically to a smooth maroon shape beneath the rib cage and above the belly's viscera. It looked like a 3-pound loaf of bread, or a slug with 2 great lobes. "Look," Larch whispered. "You rarely see it, but we've caught it napping. Look, quickly, before it moves." The nurses gaped. "The soul," Larch whispered reverentially. In fact, it was the body's largest gland, empowered with skills also ascribed to the soul. For example, it could regenerate its own abused cells. It was the liver, which Larch thought more of than he thought of the soul. But whether the delirious happiness of the Winkles was a state of mind or a state of the soul, Wilbur Larch wished that some of it could rub off on Homer Wells. The Winkles had always wanted a child, to share the world of nature with us, they said, and just to make a child happy, of course. Looking at them, Dr. Larch had his own ideas as to why they could not successfully breed. Lack of the essential concentration, Larch thought. Larch suspected that the Winkles never stopped moving long enough to mate. Perhaps, he speculated, looking at Billy Winkle, she is not really a woman. Grant had a plan. "He has no face," Dr. Larch noticed, trying to discern the man's blunt features, somewhere between his blonde beard and his blonder hair. The hair was cropped in bangs, completely concealing a low forehead. The cheeks, or what Larch could see of them, were a ridge, the eyes hidden behind them. The rest was beard, a blonde underbrush that Dr. Larch imagined Billy Winkle needed her machete to hack through. Grant's plan was that they borrow Homer for a little moose watching. The Winkles were going on a canoe trip and portage through the northern state forest, the principal fun of which was to see moose. A secondary pleasure would be introducing Homer Wells to a little white water. St. Larch felt that such a trip, in the massive hands of the Winkles, wouldn't be dangerous for Homer. He felt less sure that Homer would want to stay with these people, to actually be adopted by them. He hardly worried that the Winkles' craziness would bother the boy, and it wouldn't have. What boy is troubled by perpetual adventure? What Wilbur Larch suspected was that the Winkles would bore Homer to tears, if not to death. A camping trip in the state forest, white water now and then, a moose or two, might give the boy an idea of whether or not he could stand Grant and Billy forever. "And if you have a good time in the woods," Grant Winkle told Homer cheerfully, "then we'll take you out on the ocean." They probably ride whales, Homer imagined. They tease sharks, Dr. Larch thought. But Dr. Larch wanted Homer to try it, and Homer Wells was willing. He would try anything for St. Larch. "Nothing dangerous," Larch said sternly to the Winkles. "Oh, no, cross our hearts," cried Billy. Grant crossed his, too. Dr. Larch knew there was only one road that ran through the northern state forest. It was built by, and remained the property of, the Ramsey's Paper Company. They were not allowed to cut the trees in the state forest, but they could drive their equipment through it en route to the trees that were theirs. Only this, that Homer was going anywhere near where the Ramsey's Paper Company was operating, troubled Dr. Larch. Homer was surprised at how little room there was in the cab of the homemade safari vehicle that the Winkles drove. The equipment it carried was impressive. The canoe, the tent, the fishing gear, the cooking miscellany, the guns. But there was little room for the driver and the passengers. In the cab, Homer sat on Billy's lap. It was a big lap, but strangely uncomfortable because of the hardness of her thighs. Homer had felt a woman's lap only once before, during St. Cloud's annual three-legged race. Once a year, the boys and girls divisions amused the town with this race. It was a fundraiser for the orphanage, so everyone endured it. The last 2 years, Homer had won the race, only because his partner, the oldest girl in the girls' division, was strong enough to pick him up and run with him in her arms across the finish line. The idea was that a boy and a girl of comparable age fastened his left leg to her right. They then hopped toward the finish line, on each of their free legs, dragging the miserable so-called third leg between them. The big girl from the girls' division hadn't needed to drag Homer. She cheated. She just carried him. But last year she had fallen at the finish line, pulling Homer into her lap. By mistake, trying to get out of her lap, he'd put his hand on her breast, and she'd sharply pinched what the private school boy in Waterville had called his pecker. Her name was Melanie, which was, like several of the orphans' names in the girls' division, a typographical error. Melanie's name had been officially Melody, but the girls' division secretary was a terrible typist. The mistyping was a fortunate mistake, actually, because there was nothing melodious about the girl. She was about 16, no one really knew her exact age, and there was in the fullness of her breasts and in the roundness of her bottom very much the suggestion of melons. In the long ride north, Homer worried that Billy Winkle might pinch his pecker, too. He watched the houses disappear and the farm animals. Other cars and trucks were gone from the roads. Soon it was just a road, a single road. Most often it ran alongside water. The water ran fast. Ahead of them, for hours it seemed, loomed a mountain that had snow on the top, although it was July. The mountain had an Indian name.
"That's where we're going, Homer," Grant Winkle told the boy. "Just under all that snow there's a lake."
"The moose are crazy about the lake," Billy told Homer. "And you'll be crazy about the lake, too."
Homer didn't doubt it. It was an adventure. Dr. Larch had told him he didn't have to stay. The Winkles stopped for the night before it got dark. Between the single road and the rushing water, they pitched a tent with three rooms in it. They lit a cook stove in one of the rooms, and Billy did 100 sit-ups in another room. Homer held her feet, while Grant caught some brook trout. It was such a cool evening, there weren't any bugs. They kept the lamps running long after dark, with the tent flaps open. Grant and Billy told adventure stories. In his journal, Dr. Larch would later write, "What the hell else would they tell?" Grant told about the 60-year-old lawyer who had hired him to show him a bear giving birth. Billy showed Homer her bear scars. And then there was the man who had asked the Winkles to cast him adrift at sea in a small boat, with only one oar. This man had been interested in the sensation of survival. He wanted to see if he could find his way back to land, but he wanted the Winkles to observe him and rescue him if he was getting into real trouble. The trick to that was not letting the man know he was being observed. At night, when the fool fell asleep and drifted farther out to sea, the Winkles would cautiously tow him toward shore. But in the morning, once, even within sight of land, the man always found a way to get lost again. They finally had to rescue him when they caught him drinking salt water. He'd been so disappointed he gave them several bad checks before he finally paid his adventure fee. Adventure fee was Billy's name for it. Homer thought it might make his would-be adoptive parents self-conscious if he told them any stories about life at St. Cloud's, or, worse, about Thanksgiving in Waterville.
He felt he had to contribute something to the campfire spirit of this present adventure. But the only good stories he knew were Great Expectations and David Copperfield. Dr. Larch had let him take the copy of Great Expectations with him. It was Homer's favorite of the two. Homer asked the Winkles if he could read them a little of his favorite story. Of course, they said, they'd love it. They'd never been read to, not that they could remember. Homer was a little nervous. As many times as he'd read Great Expectations, he'd never read aloud to an audience before. But he was wonderful. He even mastered what he guessed was Joe Gargery's accent. And by the time he got to the part where Mr. Wopsle cries out, "No!" with the feeble malice of a tired man, Homer sensed he had found the proper voice for the whole tale. He felt he might also have discovered his first talent. Unfortunately, talented though he was, his reading put the Winkles fast asleep. Homer kept reading by himself through the end of Chapter 7. "Maybe it's not my reading," Homer thought. "Maybe it's the Winkles. All her sit-ups, all his trout-catching, all the fierce rigor of the indisputably great outdoors." Homer attempted to arrange the Winkles' sleeping bag, a huge single bag, comfortably around them. He blew out the lamps. He went to his own room in the vast tent and crawled into his own sleeping bag. He lay with his head by the open tent flap. He could see the stars. He could hear the nearby crashing water. It did not remind him of Three Mile Falls, because the stream here was so different from that river. It was just as fast, but it ran through a deep, narrow gorge, sparkling clean, round-bouldered, with glossy pools where Grant had caught the trout. It was not unpleasant imagining further adventures with the Winkles, but Homer had more trouble imagining a moose. Exactly how big would a moose be? Bigger than the Winkles? Homer exhibited no mistrust and certainly no fear of the Winkles. He felt for them only a detached wariness. He was sure they weren't dangerous, but they were of a slightly altered species. He fell asleep confusing the Winkles, in his child's mind, with moose. In the morning he woke up to the sound of what he was sure were moose, only to discover that it was the Winkles in the tent room next to his. The Winkles appeared to greet the morning vigorously. Although Homer had never heard human beings make love, or moose mate, he knew perfectly well that the Winkles were mating. If Dr. Larch had been present, he might have drawn new conclusions concerning the Winkles' inability to produce offspring. He would have concluded that the violent athleticism of their coupling simply destroyed, or scared to death, every available egg and sperm. Homer politely feigned sleep. The Winkles then roused him playfully. Like large dogs, they burst into his room on all fours, tugging at his sleeping bag with their teeth. "They were going to swim," they told him. They were such large people, Homer wondered at the sheer abundance of their active flesh. He also wondered how they intended to swim in the raging stream without being bashed against the boulders and swept away. Homer didn't know how to swim, not even in calm water. But the Winkles were old hands at outdoor feats of skill, and they were cunning with equipment. They threw a line across the rapids. It was called a survival rope, they told Homer. The rope attached to a rake-like cluster of spikes, which Grant Winkle neatly lodged among the rocks on the far shore of the roaring river. He then strung a second rope to this one, and then a third. These additional ropes were complicated, with metal eyelets and hooks and adjustable safety straps that went around the Winkles themselves and held them tightly at their waists. With the assistance of this truly adventuresome gear, the Winkles were able to bounce, semi-suspended, into the thick of the rapids, where they were tossed about like bathtub toys while remaining safely in the same place, attached to each other and to the so-called survival rope. It was fun for Homer to watch them. The water seemed to swallow them completely at times. Streaming sheets of it would engulf them and suck them down. Yet they would emerge in seconds, bouncing, appearing to walk across the churning, rolling foam. They played in midstream like giant blonde otters. Homer was very nearly convinced of their mastery of the elements, at least of water, and he felt himself to be on the verge of asking them to let him try the game of showering in the rapids, when it occurred to him that they couldn't hear him. If he'd called out to them, even if he'd screamed,
The whoosh of the turbid water all around the Winkles would have drowned out any noise he could muster. He had resolved, therefore, to remain sitting on the shore and watch his would-be adoptive parents play, when the ground began to shake under him. He knew this more from certain badly told stories in badly written children's books than from the felt recognition of the moving ground itself. In those children's books, when something terrible is about to happen, the ground always shakes. He almost chose not to believe it, but the ground was unmistakably trembling, a dull hammering reaching his ears. Homer watched the Winkles more closely, believing them to be in control of everything. The Winkles continued to play in the rapids. They heard nothing. They didn't feel the ground shake because they weren't on the ground. "Oh, my God, a moose is coming," thought Homer Wells. He stood up. He watched his feet hop, all by themselves, on the jumping ground. "It is a herd of moose," he thought. To add to the hammering sound, Homer now heard sharper noises, cracks, some as startling as pistol shots. He looked at the Winkles and could tell they'd heard those harsh slaps, too. Whatever it was coming. The Winkles were familiar with it. Their entire attitude changed. They were no longer playful. They seemed to be struggling, and on their faces, now disappearing in the rushing white froth, their expressions were both knowledgeable and frightened. When they got a second to look, between plunges into the rapids, they looked upstream. So did Homer, in time to see the log drive when it was about 25 yards away. The trees along the shoreline were occasionally snapped off as cleanly as kindling snapped over a knee, by a random log as big as a telephone pole but stouter, hurtling out of the water, striking a boulder and spinning for 20 feet through the air, leveling a patch of forest wherever it crashed and rolled on. The mass of logs, each as big as telephone poles, moved swiftly downstream with a wall of water in front of it. This water was not like the clear water of the river, but muddy with turmoil, clogged with slabs of bark, messy with whole chunks of ground that had been gouged out of the shore. The Ramsey's Paper Company called it a modest log drive. They said there'd been no more than 400, maybe 700 logs in that particular drive downriver. Homer Wells was still running when he reached the road, where he was safe. He turned in time to see the logs surge by. A line from the tent had been attached to the Winkles' survival rope, and the entire tent and everything in it, Homer's copy of Great Expectations, too, were swept downstream in the pounding flow and charge of logs. The Ramsey's Paper Company wouldn't recover Billy and Grant's bodies for 3 days. They found them nearly 4 miles away. Homer Wells was fairly calm. He looked upstream, waiting for more of anything. Upstream was clearly the direction whatever might come next would come from. After a while, he relaxed. He examined the Winkle safari vehicle, which looked naked without the tent and the kitchen equipment. He found some fishing gear, but he didn't dare to fish. It meant standing too close to the stream. He found some guns, but he had no idea how they worked. He felt comforted that the guns were there, however. He chose the biggest, most dangerous-looking one, a 12-gauge double-barrel shotgun, and dragged it around with him. He was quite hungry by mid-afternoon, but before it was dark he heard a logging truck coming nearer and nearer. He knew it was a full one because of the straining sound of the gears. It was also a piece of luck, on the order of his not knowing how to swim and therefore not joining the Winkles in their sport, that the truck was going Homer's way. "St. Clouds," he told the baffled driver, who was impressed with the shotgun. It was a Ramsey's Paper Company truck, and Dr. Larch was at first furious to see it pull up to the hospital entrance. "Unless this is an absolute emergency," he told the smitten nurse Edna, "I will not do a stitch of work on anyone from that company." Larch was actually disappointed to see Homer Wells, and alarmed to see the shotgun. Homer had the bewildered expression on his face of the many patients, Larch had observed, emerging from the spell of ether. "You didn't give the Winkles much of a chance, Homer," Dr. Larch said gravely. Then Homer explained why he'd come back so soon. You mean the Winkles are gone? Dr. Larch asked.
Swept away, said Homer Wells. Whoosh!
That was when Wilbur Larch gave up on finding Homer Wells a home. That was when Dr. Larch said that Homer could stay at St. Cloud's for as long as Homer felt he belonged there. That was when St. Larch said, Well then, Homer, I expect you to be of use. For Homer Wells, this was easy. Of use, he felt, was all that an orphan was born to be.
Chapter 2 The Lord's Work.
A child of Maine, Wilbur Larch was born in Portland in 1860-something. The son of a sullen, tidy woman who was among the staff of cooks and housekeepers for a man named Neil Dow, the mayor of Portland and the so-called father of the Maine law that introduced prohibition to that state. Neil Dow once ran for the presidency as the candidate of the Prohibition Party, but he won barely 10,000 votes, proving that the general voter was wiser than Wilbur Larch's mother, who worshipped her employer and saw herself more as his co-worker for temperance reform than as his servant, which she was. Interestingly, Wilbur Larch's father was a drunk, no small feat in the Portland of Mayor Dow's day. It was permitted to advertise beer in the shop windows, scotch, ale, and bitter beer, which Wilbur Larch's father consumed copiously. It was necessary, he claimed, to drink these weak brews by the bucketful in order to get a buzz on. To young Wilbur, his father never looked drunk. He never staggered or fell or lay in a stupor. He never shouted or slurred his speech. Rather, he had about him the appearance of one perpetually surprised, of one given to frequent and sudden revelations that would stop him in his tracks, or in mid-sentence, as if something had just come to him, or had just escaped him, that had preoccupied him for days. He shook his head a lot, and all his life dispensed this misinformation, that the 19,000-ton ship, the Great Eastern, which was built in Portland, was destined to sail the North Atlantic between Europe and Maine. It was the opinion of Wilbur Larch's father that the two best wharves in Portland Harbor had been built specifically for the Great Eastern, that the new and huge hotel in Portland had been built expressly to house the Great Eastern's passengers, and that someone evil, or at least corrupt, or just plain foolish, was responsible for keeping the Great Eastern from returning to her home port in Maine. Wilbur Larch's father had worked as a lathe operator during the building of the Great Eastern, and perhaps the complaining noise of that machinery and the constant buzz he felt from all the beer he consumed had deceived him. The Great Eastern had not been built for voyages to and from Portland. She was originally intended for the route to Australia, but the many delays in getting her to sea drove her owners to bankruptcy, and she was purchased for use in the North Atlantic route, for which she proved unsuitable. She was, in fact, a failure. So Wilbur Larch's father had an addled memory of his days as a lathe operator, and he had considerable loathing for temperance reform, his wife's beliefs, and his wife's employer, Mayor Neil Dow himself. In the opinion of Wilbur Larch's father, the Great Eastern didn't return to Portland because of prohibition, that curse which had limited him to a bilious dependency on Scotch ale and bitter beer. Since Wilbur knew his father only in the man's later years, when the Great Eastern was gone and his father was a porter in the Portland station of the Grand Trunk Railway, he could only imagine why working a wood-turning machine had been the high point of his father's life. As a boy, it never occurred to Wilbur Larch that his father's missing fingers were the result of too many Scotch ales and bitter beers while operating the lathe.
Just accidents, his father said.
Or that his mother's zeal for temperance reform might be the result of a lathe operator's demotion to porter. Of course, Wilbur later realized, his parents were servants. Their disappointment made Wilbur become what his teachers called a whale of a student. Although he grew up in the mayor's mansion, Wilbur Larch always used the kitchen entrance and ate his meals with the great prohibitionist's hired help. His father drank his meals down at the docks. Wilbur Larch was a good student because he preferred the company of books to overhearing his mother's talk of temperance with Mayor Dow's servants. He went to Bowdoin College and to Harvard Medical School, where a fascination with bacteria almost deterred him from practicing medicine,
almost turned him into a laboratory animal, or at least a bacteriologist. He had a gift for the field, his professor told him, and he enjoyed the careful atmosphere of the laboratory. Also, he had a burning desire to learn about bacteria. For nearly a year of medical school, young Wilbur carried a bacterium that so offended and pained him that he was driven by more than scientific curiosity to discover its cure. He had gonorrhea, a gift, indirectly, from his father. The old man, in his beer buzz, had been so proud of Wilbur that he sent him to medicine school in 1880-something with a present. He bought the boy a Portland whore, setting up his son with a night of supposed pleasure in one of the wharfside boarding houses. It was a present the boy had been too embarrassed to refuse. His father's selfish nostalgia allowed him so few gestures toward his son. His mother's bitter righteousness was selfish in her own way. Young Wilbur was touched that his father had offered to give him anything. In the boarding house, the wood dry with salt and the sea damp clinging to the curtains and to the bedspread, the whore reminded Wilbur of one of his mother's more attractive servant colleagues. He shut his eyes and tried to imagine that he was embarking on a forbidden romance in a back room of the mayor's mansion. When he opened his eyes, he saw the candlelight deepening the stretch marks across the whore's abdomen. He didn't know they were stretch marks then. The whore seemed unconcerned whether Wilbur noticed the stretch marks or not. In fact, as they fell asleep with his head on her stomach, he was vaguely wondering if the woman's wrinkles would transfer to his face, marking him. A sharp, unpleasant smell awakened him, and he moved quickly off the woman without disturbing her. In a chair in the room, the one where she'd put her clothes, someone was smoking a cigar. Wilbur saw the end glow brighter with each inhalation. He assumed that a man, the whore's next customer, was politely waiting for him to leave, but when he asked if there was a fresh candle to light, he needed to locate his clothes. It was a young girl's voice that answered him. "You could have had me for less," was all she said. He could not see her distinctly, but since there was no fresh candle, she lit his way to his clothes by puffing earnestly on her cigar, casting both a red glow and a haze of smoke over his search. He thanked her for her help and left. On the morning train to Boston, he was embarrassed to meet the whore again. A chatty woman in the daylight, she was carrying a bandbox with the authority of a chronic shopper. He felt obliged to give her his seat on the overcrowded train. A young girl was traveling with the whore. "My daughter," the whore said, indicating the girl with a jab of her thumb. The daughter reminded Wilbur that they'd already met by breathing her astonishingly foul cigar breath into his face. She was a girl not quite Wilbur's age. The whore's name was Mrs. Eames. "She rhymes with screams," Wilbur's father had told him. Mrs. Eames told Wilbur she was a widow who lived a proper life in Boston, but that in order to afford such a life she found it necessary to sell herself in some out-of-the-way town. She begged Wilbur to allow her to keep her appearances and her reputation intact in Boston. Wilbur not only assured her that her reputation was safe with him, he also, unasked, paid her more money of his own, on the spot, than his father had originally paid the woman. The amount of the original payment, he learned later, when his father told Wilbur that Mrs. Eames was a proper Portlander of good reputation, who occasionally was obliged to sell herself in Boston so that she might afford to keep up her appearances in Portland. As an old favor to Wilbur's father, she had allowed, just this once, the exception of lowering herself in her hometown. Wilbur's father didn't know that Mrs. Eames had a daughter, who, by her own confession, cost less than her mother, and made no pretense of keeping up appearances in either Boston or Portland. The sullen girl never spoke on the train ride into Boston's North Station. Her cigar breath and her scornful gaze spoke for her. Wilbur never told his father that there was some contradiction regarding which town Mrs. Eames had a good reputation in, and he never told his father that he caught the clap from Mrs. Eames, who might not have known she had it. At medical school, Wilbur learned that gonorrhea could live in the fallopian tubes of females for years. Only the appearance of an abscess in the pelvis might allow the woman to know that she carried the disease. The symptomatology, the discharge and so forth, could go unnoticed for a long time. It did not go unnoticed in Wilbur Larch. The bacterial infection, in these pre-penicillin days, lived on for months in young Wilbur, giving him his passionate interest in bacteriology before burning itself out. It left his urethra scarred and his prostate rocky. It left him fond of ether, too, because the ether sleeps he occasionally administered to himself relieved him of the burning sensation he experienced, both when he urinated and when he dreamed. This singular and painful encounter with sexual pleasure, in combination with Wilbur's memory of his parents' loveless marriage, convinced the would-be doctor that a life of sexual abstinence was both medically and philosophically sound. In the same year, 1880-something, that Wilbur Larch became a doctor, Neil Dow died. In grief, Wilbur Larch's mother shortly followed her temperance hero to the grave. A few days later, Wilbur's father auctioned every item from their servants' rooms in the former mayor's mansion and rode the Grand Trunk Railway to Montreal, a town less temperance-minded than Portland, and where Wilbur Larch's father pushed his liver beyond limits. His body was returned to Portland on the same Grand Trunk Railway that had carried the former lathe operator away. Wilbur Larch met the train. He played the porter to his father's remains. From the near cadavers of the cirrhotic that he had seen during his first internship, young Dr. Larch knew exactly what must have been his father's condition at the end. Cirrhosis turns the liver to a mass of scars and lumps. The skin reflects the bile of jaundice. The stools lighten. The urine darkens. The blood doesn't clot. Dr. Larch doubted that his father would have even noticed the accompanying impotence. How moving to conclude that young Larch chose to be an obstetrician because the loss of his parents inspired him to bring more children into the world. But the road that led Larch to obstetrics was strewn with bacteria. The demonstrator of bacteriology at Harvard Medical School, a Dr. Harold Ernst, is best remembered as one of the first college baseball pitchers to throw a curveball. He was also the first college baseball player to become a bacteriologist. In the early morning laboratory before Dr. Ernst, the former curveball pitcher, would arrive to set up his demonstrations, young Wilbur Larch would be all alone. He didn't feel alone in the presence of so many bacteria growing in the little petri dishes, in the presence of the bacteria inhabiting his urethra and his prostate gland. He would milk a drop of pus from his penis onto an ordinary stained slide. Magnified more than 1,000 times, the villains he spotted every morning under the microscope were still smaller than common red ants. Years later, Larch would write that the gonococci looked stooped, like two tall visitors in an igloo. "They bend," he wrote, "as if they have waists and are bowing to each other." Young Larch would stare at his pus until Dr. Ernst would arrive and greet his little living experiments all over the lab, as if they were his old baseball teammates. "Honestly, Larch," the famous bacteriologist said one morning, "the way you look into that microscope, you appear to be plotting revenge." But it was not the smirk of vengeance that Dr. Ernst recognized on Wilbur Larch's face. It was simply the intensity with which Larch was emerging from his ether days. The young medical student had discovered that the light, tasty vapor was a safe, effective killer of his pain. In his days spent fighting the dancing gonococci, Larch had become quite a knowledgeable imbiber of ether. By the time the fierce bacteria had burned themselves out, Larch was an ether addict. He was an open-drop method man. With one hand, he held a cone over his mouth and nose. He made this mask himself by wrapping many layers of gauze around a cone of stiff paper. With his other hand, he wet the cone. He used a quarter-pound ether can punctured with a safety pin. The drops that fell from the elbow of the safety pin fell in exactly the correct size and at exactly the correct rate. It was the way he would give ether to his patients, too, except that he gave himself much less. When the hand that held the ether can felt unsteady, he put the can down. When the hand that held the cone over his mouth and nose dropped to his side, the cone fell off his face. It wouldn't stay in place if no one held it. He felt nothing of the panic that a patient being anesthetized with ether experiences. He never approached the moment when there wasn't enough air to breathe. Before that happened, he always dropped the mask. When young Dr. Larch first set out from the south branch of the Boston Lying In to deliver babies in the poor districts of the city, he had a place in his mind where the peace of ether resided. Although he carried the ether can and the gauze cone with him, he didn't always have time to anesthetize the patient. The woman's labor was often too far advanced for the ether to help her. Of course, he used it when he had the time. He would never share the opinion of some of his elder colleagues that ether was a deviation from the given, that children should be brought forth in pain. Larch delivered his first child to a Lithuanian family in a cold-water top-floor apartment, the surrounding streets littered with squashed fruit and tattered vegetables and horse droppings. There was no ice to put on the abdomen, over the uterus, in case of postpartum hemorrhage. There was a pot of water already boiling on the stove, but Larch wished he could sterilize the entire apartment. He sent the husband out for ice. He measured the woman's pelvis. He mapped out the fetus. He listened to its heartbeat while he watched a cat toying with a dead mouse on the kitchen floor. There was a would-be grandmother present. She spoke Lithuanian to the woman in labor. To Dr. Larch, she spoke a strange language of gestures, which suggested to him that the would-be grandmother was feeble-minded. She indicated that a large mole on her face was either a source of hysterical pleasure or hysterical pain. Larch couldn't tell which. Perhaps she simply wanted him to remove it, either before or after he delivered the baby. She found several ways to exhibit the mole, once by holding a spoon under it as if it were about to fall, once capping it with a teacup and revealing it suddenly, as if it were a surprise or a kind of magician's trick. But the zeal she brought to each revelation of the mole suggested to Wilbur Larch that the old woman simply forgot that she had already shown him her mole. When the husband returned with the ice, he trod on the cat, which voiced its disapproval in tones that made Wilbur Larch think the child was being born. Larch was grateful not to have to use the forceps. It was a short, safe, loud delivery, following which the husband refused to wash the baby. The grandmother offered, but Larch feared that her combination of excitement and feeble-mindedness would cause an accident. Indicating, as well as he could, without the benefit of Lithuanian, that the child should be washed in warm water and soap, but not boiled in the pot on the stove and not held head down under the cold water tap, Larch turned his attention to the afterbirth, which refused to come away. The way the patient kept bleeding, Larch knew he would soon be faced with serious hemorrhage. He begged the husband to hack him some ice. The strong fellow had brought a whole block, borrowing the ice company's tongs for this purpose, and standing in the kitchen with the tongs on his shoulder in a menacing fashion. The block of ice could cool the uteri of several bleeding patients. To apply it whole to a single patient would likely crush the uterus, if not the patient. At this moment, the grandmother lost her grip on the soapy child and dropped it among the dishes soaking in the cold water sink. This happened the instant that the husband again trod upon the cat. Seizing the moment when he saw that the grandmother and the husband were distracted, Larch grasped the top of his patient's uterus through her abdominal wall and squeezed hard. The woman screamed and grabbed his hands. The grandmother, abandoning the baby among the dishes, tackled Larch at the waist and bit him between the shoulder blades. The husband retrieved the child from the sink with one hand, but he raised the ice tongs over Larch with the other. Whereupon, lucky Wilbur Larch felt the placenta separate. When he calmly pointed to its appearance, the grandmother and the husband seemed more in awe of it than of the child. After washing the baby himself and giving the mother some ergot, he bowed a wordless goodbye. Leaving the apartment, he was surprised to hear a commotion almost the instant he closed the door. The grandmother, the iced patient, the husband, all shouting in Lithuanian, and the baby giving forceful voice to its first family quarrel. It was as if the delivery, and Dr. Larch's entire appearance, had been only a brief interruption to a life of unintelligible turmoil. Larch navigated the dark stairs and groped his way outside. He stepped on a rotting head of lettuce, which gave under his foot with the disquieting softness of a newborn baby's skull. This time he did not confuse the cat's terrible yowl with the sounds a child can make. He looked up in time to see the object flying through the window of the Lithuanian apartment. He was in time to dodge it. It had clearly been hurled at him, and Larch wondered what particular, perhaps Lithuanian, offense he had caused these poor people. Larch was shocked to see that the object thrown from the window, and now dead on the ground at his feet, was the cat. But he was not that shocked. For a passing second, he feared it might have been the child. He had been told by his professor of obstetrics at Harvard that the tensile strength of the newborn was a marvel, but Larch knew that the tensile strength of a cat was also considerable, and he noted that the beast had failed to survive its fall. "Here in St. Cloud's," Dr. Larch would write, "I am constantly grateful for the South End of Boston." He meant he was grateful for its children and for the feeling they gave him, that the act of bringing them into this world was perhaps the safest phase of their journey. Larch also appreciated the blunt reminder given him by the prostitutes in the South End. They recalled for him the painful gift of Mrs. Eames. He could not see the prostitutes without imagining their bacteria under the microscope. And he could not imagine those bacteria without feeling the need for the giddy warmth of ether. Just a sniff. Just a light dose. And a light doze. He was not a drinking man, Dr. Larch, and he had no taste for tobacco. But now and then, he provided his sagging spirits with an ether frolic. One night, when Wilbur was dozing in the South End branch of the Boston Lying In, he was informed by one of the doctors that there was an emergency arrival, and that it was his turn. Although she had lost a lot of weight and all of her youthfulness since Larch had last seen her, he had no trouble recognizing Mrs. Eames. She was so frightened and in such intense pain that she had difficulty catching her breath and more trouble telling the nurse receptionist her name. "Rhymes with screams," said Dr. Larch helpfully. If Mrs. Eames recognized him right away, she didn't let on. She was cold to the touch, her pulse was very fast, and her abdomen was as hard and white as the knuckles of a tight fist. Larch could detect no signs of labor, and he couldn't hear the heartbeats of the fetus, which Larch couldn't help imagining as having features similar to Mrs. Eames's sullen teenage daughter. How old would she be now, he wondered. Still about his own age. That much he had time to remember before attending to his diagnosis of Mrs. Eames. Hemorrhage within the abdomen. He operated as soon as the house officer could locate the necessary donors for the transfusion. "Mrs. Eames," he asked her softly, still seeking some recognition from her. "How's your father, Wilbur?" she asked him, just before he operated. Her abdomen was full of blood. He sponged away, looking for the source, and saw that the hemorrhage issued from a 6-inch rupture in the back of the uterus. Larch performed a cesarean section and delivered a stillborn child, the pinched, scornful face of which forcibly reminded him of the cigar-smoking daughter. He wondered why Mrs. Eames had come here alone. To this point in the operation, young Larch felt in charge. Despite his memories of the woman opened up before him, and his memories of her transmitted disease, which he was only recently rid of, he felt he was handling a fairly manageable emergency. But when he tried to sew up Mrs. Eames's uterus, his stitches simply pulled through the tissue, which he noticed was the texture of a soft cheese. Imagine trying to put stitches in Munster. He had no choice then. He had to remove the uterus. After all the transfusions, Larch was surprised that Mrs. Eames's condition seemed pretty good. He conferred with a senior surgeon in the morning. At the Boston Lying In, it was standard that an obstetrician's background was surgical. Larch had interned in surgery at Mass General. And the senior surgeon shared young Larch's bafflement with the disintegrating consistency of Mrs. Eames's uterus. Even the rupture was a puzzle. There was no scar of a previous cesarean section that could have given way. The placenta could not have weakened the wall of the uterus because the afterbirth had been on the other side of the uterus from the tear. There had been no tumor. For 48 hours, Mrs. Eames did very well. She consoled young Wilbur on the death of his parents. "I never knew your mother, of course," she confided. She again expressed her concern that Wilbur consider her reputation, which Wilbur assured her he would, and had, by refraining from expressing his fears to the senior surgeon that the condition of Mrs. Eames might somehow be the result of gonorrhea. He briefly wondered which story Mrs. Eames was using at the moment regarding her reputation, whether she was claiming to live a proper life in Portland or in Boston, whether a third city was now involved, and necessarily a third fictitious life. On the third day after the removal of her strange uterus, Mrs. Eames filled up with blood again, and Wilbur Larch reopened her wound. This time he was quite afraid of what he'd find. At first he was relieved. There was not as much blood in her abdomen as before. But when he sponged the blood away, he perforated the intestine, which he had hardly touched. And when he lifted up the injured loop to close the hole, his fingers passed as easily through the intestine as through gelatin. If all her organs were this same fragile jelly, Larch knew Mrs. Eames wouldn't live very long. She lived 3 more days. The night she died, Larch had a nightmare. His penis fell off in his hands. He tried to sew it back on, but it kept disintegrating. Then his fingers gave way in a similar fashion. How like a surgeon, he thought. Fingers are valued above penises. How like Wilbur Larch? This helped to strengthen Larch's conviction regarding sexual abstinence. He waited for whatever had destroyed Mrs. Eames to claim him, but the autopsy, which was performed by a distinguished pathologist, seemed off the track. Scurvy, the pathologist said. So much for pathologists, thought Wilbur Larch. Scurvy indeed. Mrs. Eames was a prostitute, Larch told the pathologist respectfully. She wasn't a sailor. But the pathologist was sure about it. It had nothing to do with the gonorrhea, nothing to do with the pregnancy. Mrs. Eames had died of the sailor's curse. She had not a trace of vitamin C, and, the pathologist said, she had destruction of connective tissue and the tendency to bleed that goes with it. Scurvy. Though this was a puzzle, it convinced Larch that it wasn't a venereal puzzle, and he had one good night's sleep before Mrs. Eames's daughter came to see him. "It's not my turn, is it?" he sleepily asked the colleague who roused him. "She says you're her doctor," the colleague told him. He did not recognize Mrs. Eames's daughter, who had once cost less than Mrs. Eames. Now she would have charged more than her mother could get. If on the train she had seemed only a few years younger than Wilbur, now she seemed several years older. Her sullen teenage quality had matured in a brash and caustic fashion. Her makeup, her jewelry, and her perfume were excessive. Her dress was slatternly. Her hair, in a single thick braid with a seagull feather stuck in it, was so severely pulled back from her face that the veins in her temples seemed strained, and her neck muscles were tensed, as if a violent lover had thrown her to her back and held her there by her strong, dark pigtail. She greeted Wilbur Larch by roughly handing him a bottle of brown liquid, its pungent odor escaping through a leaky cork stopper. The bottle's label was illegibly stained. "That's what did her in," the girl said with a growl. "I ain't having any. There's other ways." "Is it Miss Eames?" Wilbur Larch asked, searching for her memorable cigar breath. "I said there's other ways," Miss Eames said. "I ain't so far along as she was. I ain't quick." Wilbur Larch sniffed the bottle in his hand. He knew what quick meant. If a fetus was quick, it meant the mother had felt it move. It meant the mother was about half through her gestation period, usually in her 4th or 5th month. To some doctors, with religion, when a fetus was quick, it meant it had a soul. Wilbur Larch didn't think anyone had a soul, but until the middle of the 19th century, the common law's attitude toward abortion was simple, and to Wilbur Larch, sensible. Before quickening, before the first felt movement of the fetus, abortion was legal. More important to the doctor and Wilbur Larch, it was not dangerous to the mother to perform an abortion before the fetus was quick. After the 3rd month, whether the fetus was quick or not, Wilbur Larch knew it had a grip on the uterus that required more force to break. For example, the liquid in the bottle Wilbur Larch was holding had not provided sufficient force to break the grip that Mrs. Eames's fetus had on her, although apparently it had exerted enough force to kill the fetus and turn Mrs. Eames's insides to mush. "It's gotta be pure poison," Mrs. Eames's tough daughter remarked to Wilbur Larch, who dabbed a little of his beloved ether on the bottle's stained label, cleaning it up enough to read. "French Lunar Solution. Restores female monthly regularity. Stops suppression." Suppression, young Larch knew, was a euphemism for pregnancy. "Caution. dangerous to married women, almost certainly causes miscarriages. The label concluded, which of course was why Mrs. Eames had taken it and taken it. Larch had studied the abuse of aborticides and medicine.